Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, hi everyone. Very pleased to welcome onto the show Ross Tu, who's one of our provider attorneys out of Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area. He's also one of our state lawyers. We've had maybe two attorneys on the podcast so far that provide estate planning work for the estate clients that we send. We generate estate leads, family law, immigration, and very soon we're going to be going into the bankruptcy arena. So stay tuned for that. We'll send a notification about bankruptcy leads becoming available in the near future. But estate planning is an area that we haven't had as much input and feedback on. And Ross has been very, very effective at working with these folks and finding ways. He cultivates a culture of what he would describe as being a flexibility and willingness around, you know, finding ways to serve the clients. He has a very client-centered approach to the way he works with folks. And, you know, he didn't really have his numbers, but, you know, we looked into it and he's been converting about 50% or more of his leads into paying clients. So one out of two. So obviously doing a really, really amazing job working with these folks. And so on this episode, we really dive into what is it, what does that mean to be flexible? How is he being flexible, both with, you know, the location of the courts that he's willing to work with, and more importantly, with his fee structure and the way he's offering, you know, what could be called pay-as-you-go, or basically breaking down all of the tasks that are involved in each thing that he's going to be getting done for the clients into specific segments and then billing one segment at a time. And, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, why some attorneys are resistant to work with attorney clients in this way and why they, you know, a lot of them feel like they have to get the money up front. And for a lot of attorneys, you know, as we talk about in this episode, it's because they believe, you know, they're not going to get paid, or they believe it's going to be less profitable to take payments one phase at a time as it is to pay the full amount. And so we, you know, kind of questioned that reality, and we looked at his numbers and kind of broke down, you know, how many cases he's gotten, how many cases he's that have, you know, defaulted on him, and how many clients he's been able to acquire in addition to the full service cases that can pay him up front, how many additional clients he's been able to acquire by being willing to work with folks on this type of pay as you go, you know, broken up, or he's not requiring the full amount up front. And the result and the numbers of this, which, you know, right here on this interview, are astounding. And so this is kind of what this podcast is all about, is having more and more examples of attorneys like yourselves that are offering these options in their practice and only helping a ton of people that otherwise would be going it alone or stuck representing themselves or not able to handle the case, their legal matters at all, to the point where they're having quality representation from a, you know, compassionate attorney like yourself in a way that they can afford, and also how profitable that is for attorneys to do that. And I think once we really get that message out to more and more attorneys that not only can you help a lot of people, but you can also make a lot of more money doing it, that we'll start to shift the tides, and becoming and offering unbundled legal services will be something that becomes more of a self-evident practice as opposed to something that's, you know, ridiculed or, you know, not yet accepted. So really great interview, very transparent look at, you know, the economics and impact of unbundled services, even the estate arena. So let's get right into it. This interview with Ross Tu, one of our provider attorneys out of the Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area. All right. Hey, Ross, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Real pleasure to have you on today. It's we've only had maybe two or three estate lawyers on the podcast so far, and you are one of our estate lawyers in the Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas metro area, and have recently expanded to Austin as well. And so, you've also, you know, been doing really well with the leads. And so we're looking forward to kind of unpacking and diving into what's been working so well for you. And so I just want to thank you for taking the time today to share what's been going so well.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate you guys taking the time to recognize how all this is working. I've listened to the podcast couple of times and taken some notes from there, and it's helped me make some moves in my practice that, you know, are starting to pay some dividends.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that the podcast has been helpful for you as well. So maybe a great place to start, Ross, is just to give give folks that are, you know, just hearing you here a little background on as to how you got your start in the practice of law, the region you serve, and why maybe you decided to provide services in estate law.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, whenever I was going to law school, I was going to Texas Wesleyan back when it was Wesleyan, now it's Texas A&M. You know, at the time, it was literally, well, property law. And I was just fascinated with the springing interests and things of that sort and life estates and kind of how all that operated. And so from there, you know, got into doing some probate seminars and guardianship and things of that sort, and then, you know, did an internship with the IRS in their estate tax section, and so I had just kind of gripped me right from the beginning, just how property sort of passes and what all you can do with it, where you can put it, you know, trust planning, things of that sort, and so it's just really that's kind of at the heart of it. And then, you know, where that leads you to is writing wills for people, setting up trusts, and then, you know, they come back to you and want to get their wills probated. And so that's really been the focus of my practice, purely out of my own interest in the subject. You know, there really wasn't any reason why I had to go this route. It's not like this was the first job offered to me or something like that. It was just, this was the topic that I kind of nerded out on, enjoy practicing it now.
Yeah. From what we've been hearing, as far as the clients enjoy working with you too. From what I've heard from Graham and is that you've been one of the highest converting estate lawyers in the network. Just any leads throughout Dallas and now you've started to expand it to Austin. We'll kind of focus on your process, but sounds like you've been, you know, starting to experiment with working with some folks both on a little bit longer distance in Austin as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the, you know, part of what makes that feasible is just flexibility, and so that's, you know, kind of thinking about how my practice differentiates from, you know, say the firms that I've worked at and other attorneys that I've run into, folks that refer cases to me. You know, I don't, in probate there, especially in Texas, there's a tendency to create sort of an assembly line. And I certainly, you know, for the cases that are just straight down the middle, you know, it's just very, very straightforward, bring in the will, probate it as munificent a title or probate it and get an independent executor appointed. You know, doing those types of real straightforward cases, you know, of course you have just sort of basic systems in place that allow you to process those cases and handle them. But then part of, you know, the willingness to go out to say a county that's two or three or five counties over, you know, and being willing to do a little bit of traveling around the state. I mean, one of the leads that I was sent from down in Austin actually ended up, the will needed to be probated in Texarkana. And so he and I have just been communicating by email and phone and doing a little bit of, you know, he has to send me the original will by mail that I got to forward onto the court. But then, yeah, the first time we meet, we'll be out in Texarkana whenever we go to prove up the will. And so, you know, places that I worked previously that, you know, something like that, working with somebody so far away, and then both of you having to travel so far to get the work finished. Yeah, that just wasn't a case that I could take whenever I was working there. And so running my own practice, you know, I kind of like Texas. I like getting out and traveling around. And so, you know, I got family all over, so any excuse to get out and about, you know, I'm willing to do that kind of work, and I get paid for it, and it, you know, it's rewarding in its own right. So really that flexibility and willingness to figure out a way uh, to serve a client. That's, you know, that's kind of the sort of the basic jumping off point whenever I start working with folks.
Yeah, and what I'd love to do is kind of flesh that out, that flexibility. You mentioned that, you know, the way you work, that you kind of differentiate yourself, or the what you're doing is differentiated from the way a lot of other firms work. Maybe you could share what you see as being those specific differentiators. Obviously, there's the philosophy and the approach, like you're talking about, as far as, you know, being flexible with, you know, locations and courts, and then obviously a willingness to try to serve clients. I really like that philosophy and that approach, because that's certainly going to come through in the way you talk to your clients and focus on finding creative ways to serve them. So maybe we can start to explore what some of those ways are that maybe other firms, aren't typically employing.
Yeah. So there's several areas. One, and I think this is really fundamental. None of us are trying to run a nonprofit firm. Is fee structure and how you structure the fees so that you can serve clients that maybe you have even been to see other attorneys and just couldn't come up with large upfront deposits, or weren't comfortable handing over a credit card and getting charged, you know, X amount every month, and not really being able to, you know, backpedal out of it if they didn't feel comfortable. And so one of the things, I actually, it's kind of odd given how so much of what I do relies on, you know, technology, but I've gone away from even accepting credit cards. I do sometimes accept things through like PayPal or something like that, but for the most part, I work on a cash and check basis, and so I'm waiting for the snail mail at times. But one of the aspects of the fee structure, I do a lot of fixed fees. And we really take the time to break down all the steps in the case and make sure that, you know, if I'm, you know, ideally, and I've submitted enough bills to the probate court, I know, you know, what a reasonable amount of time is to spend on each task. And so being very upfront with clients about here's what's actually entailed, and being able to put a period at the end of that, find that's something clients are really looking for is, I don't want you to just leave me with this open-ended, yeah, I'm going to take your big deposit, but then, you know, I may ask for even more than you're paying me up front whenever all of this is done. Certainly there are cases where they're either contested, or there's, you know, pending litigation in a decedent's estate, or there's something going on that really does necessitate them just, you know, opening up the faucet and letting it run until you get the work done. And so in those kind of cases, you know, that's how I handle it. And I'm very, you know, just very direct with the client about that needing to take place. And typically, in the cases where I can offer fixed fees, or I can offer payment schedules, or even working in decedent's estates, oftentimes, if you're having to go through dependent administration, my attorney's fees are actually ordered by the court at the end of the case. And so some of these, you know, as long as I don't have to be out of pocket any expenses, you know, so I take, you know, a relatively small deposit from the client to cover filing fees and things of that sort, then, you know, it really motivates me to get the case pushed along and wrapped up so I can get the court to issue an order for me to get paid. And that's just a reality of dealing with decedent's estates is, you know, at least here in Texas, attorney's fees, the costs of administration are one of the first, you know, top tier creditor claims in an estate. And they do that for a reason, you know, so I take advantage of it. And at times, clients pay me a big deposit and I reimburse them. At other times, I'm dealing with a lot of folks that they just don't have the means. They don't have the money. They've tried to go to legal aid. Legal aid says, yeah, I mean, we could take your case, but we don't have any probate attorneys that can do this on a pro bono basis. And so they're left out in the cold. And then once we meet, you know, I'm able to show them that, yeah, there's a way that I can get paid. You can get good representation and you can get your case dealt with. And everybody, you know, everybody comes out whole at the end of it. So flexibility in fees is one of those things. I just work with people where they're at. You know, obviously I have an idea of what I want to get paid on each case whenever it walks in the door. And oftentimes by taking the time to really explore, okay, you're bringing me a will, but what are we actually trying to accomplish to get it probated? And you start getting into the real issues that clients are dealing with. What's the practical problem that they have? Oftentimes that actually leads to doing additional work that's sort of tangential to the administration of the estate at times. And you end up, getting more fees for doing more work. And so it turns into a good, it's a good place to start. Just being flexible enough to meet the client where they're at. And sometimes it pays big to, to take not really much of a gamble because, like I said, you're a top tier creditor. Yeah, you'll get paid out of the estate whenever everything's said and done. And so that just kind of comes down to the willingness and recognizing, I think we're all aware that there's a access to justice gap. You know, there are folks that are so indigent that legal aid steps in and they can actually get some representation. And then there's folks that have the money to pay the big deposits to bigger firms. But there's a lot of folks that, they don't have $5,000-$10,000 to put up for a will contest. I've been able to take some of those cases on and have some success with them, and eventually get paid by the court. But, that part of that's just being able to wait. And, running my own shop, that's a bit of flexibility that I have that I get to take advantage of. Another aspect of, what differentiates, how I operate from, say a bigger firm is, part of that's the geographic limitation. It doesn't bother me a bit to spend a couple hours on the road to get out to some far-flung county. I think we have 240 some odd counties here in Texas, a big state. So there's people all over that need help, and they may live here, but the person whose estate we need to settle is out a ways, and so that's where we need to go to get it done. And so my willingness to go and do that, and of course my clients pay me to, for the cost of getting to and from, and so my willingness to spend those hours to go out and do that is something that I think a lot of big firms, at least whenever I was working for other folks, that's not really an option. I couldn't take that case because they just look at that as just purely wasted time. Well, once you get into it and it turns out there's some claims in that estate that you get to pursue and you end up with a good paying case, that couple hours on the road just, fades in the distance. I mean, that ends up being time well spent, because you get to take on a case that ends up being really worthwhile. So, in large part, I think it's the, I really only answer myself. So, I can take on stuff and I can approach it with, kind of a problem solving, standpoint rather than a money making standpoint. And the beauty part is I still make money. Yeah. So, and clients get served and that's really what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I really appreciate that you recognize that access to justice gap and see it as, a necessary part of your practice to find ways to work within people's budgets and meet them where they're at, like you're describing. That's, certainly been a theme and a an underlying value of, you know, all the attorneys that come on this podcast and, you know, furthermore, work with us across the United States. So I'm really pleased to hear that you've been embodying that principle and that virtue. One of the things I'd love to just kind of ask you, is it unusual to some degree for estate attorneys to take cases in which they get paid, you know, out of the estate once it's settled? Is that something that is not a normal practice, or it seems like that would just make sense that if that's an option that you would work with people, but obviously there's some challenges as far as holding your costs and stuff in the meantime and waiting to get paid, but maybe you could just enlighten on that.
Yeah. So, you know, here in Texas, one of the first things that's supposed to get paid out of an estate, you know, burial expenses, things of that sort. But right up there at the top of, you know, the priority of creditors is, you know, the cost of administration. And so, especially in dependent administrations, you know, one of the steps that we take as we put a bow on the case is to, you know, ask for our attorney's fees to be paid out of the estate. And, you know, with dependent administration, the court has to authorize, you know, essentially every action that the administrator takes. And so, you know, paying the attorney's fees is one of those, and the court auditors review your billing and make sure that you're charging a reasonable rate, and, you know, based on your experience, the complexity, the novelty of the case. You know, make sure that the time that you spent is appropriate for the task. And so, you know, having submitted those bills to the court a time or two, you start to figure out, all right, here's how much time it should take, here's how much this should cost a client for you to handle a certain task. And so, you know, that gives you a better idea of how to prepare people for the fees that they should expect in cases. And yeah, it's fairly common that the attorneys get the bulk of their fees paid, you know, at some stopping point, you know, in the midst of the administration or you know, at the very end, whenever the final distributions of the estate are being made. And so, you know, I think so to answer your question, no, that's fairly common. However, my approach to it of being willing to wait, you know, being willing to wait until I actually get the job done before I see the bulk of my fees, you know, I've had more than a few clients come to me where they have been fired by their attorney because they couldn't keep up with paying the attorney's fees as they went. You know, and they're $5,000-$6,000 into a case, and they're pretty much tapped out, and there's still work to be done. And so, you know, some of these firms, they need the cash flow to support the overhead right then. You know, so they expect their clients to pay all of the costs of administration out of pocket until, you know, if they get awarded attorney's fees by the court, then, you know, assuming they would reimburse the client at that point. And I've been able to do that with some clients. So yeah, they had the means to go ahead and make a substantial deposit, and I billed against that. And then, whenever attorney's fees are awarded by the court, reimburse the client and settle up with them, you know, at that point. But for a lot of folks who don't have the means to do that, that's where, you know, my willingness to wait, you know, my patience, it's, you know, I kind of view it as a longer term, proposition. You know, my practice is not just a month to month or year to year, thing. It's something that, you know, I build up fees in some of these estates where they're contested, and we just keep going on and on with mediations and negotiations and trying to reach agreements on different issues. And so, you know, on those, you know, what you end up with at the end of the day is well worth the time that you spent on it. But, you know, it didn't do anything to pay the rent for the last, you know, 12 or 14 months. So, you know, that's running a lean practice like I do really enables me to absorb, you know, absorb the time that I've spent on it, that I know that I get paid for eventually. So, you know, I think that's one of those aspects where, say, a bigger firm that has a lot more overhead can't necessarily be as patient with cases like that as I can.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, I think it also has to do with the individual firms running, how they're running their practice. I mean, there's a lot of sole practitioners that maybe not be able to manage that cash flow. Is there anything that you're specifically that you do to be able to run a lean practice? Do you, you know, every time you get paid, you set a certain percentage aside? I mean, is there certain things that you're doing in the way you run your practice where, you know, revenues that come in, you don't see them necessarily as you put a portion aside, or is there a way that you manage that so that you can continue to be able to offer that patient willingness as far as the way in which you're getting paid on those long-term cases where you're not running into a cash flow problem?
Yeah. And in the way that I did that, you know, I didn't just start out my practice by taking on these bigger long-term cases. Those were the result of, having a reputation for being able to handle, what would you call it? Sort of quirky circumstances, things that don't really fit on another attorney's assembly line. And you know, that was a couple years into my practice before I started taking on those cases. And so the cash flow for just my month-to-month operations comes from doing a lot of basic estate planning, doing very down the middle, probates of wills and things of that sort. And for those types of cases, I would say in probably 80 or 90% of those, estate planning, of course, they pay for it all up front whenever we bring them in, and take care of their will drafting and signing. And oftentimes I handle those in one office visit. You know, we correspond by email. I send questionnaires. We have some, get the client to provide me enough information so that whenever we sit down, I have pretty good idea of exactly what it is that they need. And then we could really dive into some of the details, make sure that there's not any other issues that their estate plan needs to take into consideration. And then we get things drafted and get them executed, and people walk out with good quality estate planning. And it's, it's not that I'm not the cheapest guy on the block, but it's also, a lot more reasonable than some of the folks out, really, really drilling folks on living trusts and things of that sort. So the way that I'm able to absorb, these bigger cases that have, bigger payouts down the road, is by, just being very efficient and having a good volume of both leads and referrals, in estate planning and the more simple probate matters. And so that, I call it hitting singles. The bigger cases are home runs, but I just hit a lot of singles, each month. And that enables me to keep the lights on, keep the kids fed, the whole bit. And then, whenever these bigger cases finally pay out, a lot of that is what's getting set aside. To sort of build up the ability to take on more complex cases, to do more discovery, to bring in expert witnesses in more complex litigation. So that's that's really the way that I operate. I sort of treat the bigger cases as not, I don't rely on them or count on them as part of my, part of my monthly cash flow. And they're also unpredictable. The simple estate planning, very straightforward probate work, those are very predictable. And I think that's the, assembly line that a lot of attorneys feel comfortable working in. And then there's the other cases, and those I just don't count on them to pay off at any particular point. I just know that they do. And whenever they do, it gives me plenty of breathing room to, either invest in my practice or to set money aside you know, more complex cases down the road.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point, that you're not counting on these home runs going through in order for you to, you know, keep your practice afloat. You keep your practice afloat by hitting singles and doubles all day long, and have that be your operating capital. And then when a home run happens to hit, and you know, being able to be efficient in the way that you've described, hitting singles enables you to swing for the home runs whenever those pitches, you know, to keep with the analogy, come across the plate. Because you know that you can continue to operate, because you're being so efficient and lean in your day-to-day operations, that you can swing for the home runs, and then those are kind of almost like bonus when they finally do hit.
Indeed.
So I'd like to kind of circle back on some things you said earlier that I think are really important. Number one, first of all, I think you're the first person that said, yeah, that you were taking credit cards and then kind of decided to not take credit cards anymore. Most attorneys are moving in the direction of they never took credit cards, and now they're realizing, okay, I need to start taking credit cards. Can you just make a quick comment on why you've actually gone in the opposite direction? Because that's the first we've heard of that, kind of moving away from this like credit card and automated processing trend.
Yeah, so one of the items is just the processing fees, you know, and maybe I just picked the wrong credit card processing company, you know, but I was looking at just as a percentage of some of the deposits that I was taking, and you know, clients seemed fairly resistant to absorbing that cost. So, you know, it's 3% out of, you know, a $5,000 deposit. Well, you know, they don't want to pay that cost. And so I end up eating that for nothing, you know, and it doesn't, I just kind of looked at it as, well, if you have the money, you have the money. And if you don't have the money, then don't go further into debt, you know, just to be able to hire me, especially if it's a case where I know that there's, you know, I know that there's a payoff at the end. You know, I'd prefer to steer clear of using credit cards altogether. And you know, it was, you know, to the tune of several hundred dollars a month that I ended up saving by getting away from just accepting credit cards on every case. And you know, that's several hundred dollars that I can put towards, you know, acquiring more leads, towards marketing. And so, you know, I just think the money is better spent there. And you know, if a client comes to me and they simply can't work with me unless I'm willing to accept a credit card, then, you know, it just sounds like we're not going to be able to work together, you know, which has happened one time, you know, out of, you know, probably north of 100, new client meetings that I've had since I stopped accepting credit cards.
Yeah.
So if that's the trade-off, then, you know, I think I'm, you know, I think it's a good decision for me. Now there's other folks that, you know, they probably do have a system in place, and they have people that are tracking billing, and they're doing these automated payments and things of that sort.
Yeah.
And that probably works really well for them. But you know, for me, it just never really took with me. I didn't care for the automated payments each month. I prefer to, you know, bill clients for what work I've actually done, and then to, you know, settle up with them either, you know, in via check or, you know, with the understanding that I get paid down the road. And so, yeah, that's basically how I arrived where I was at, where I just said, you know, I'm not accepting them. I don't want to pay for the privilege of accepting them whenever clients aren't even paying me with them at times. And so I just moved away from it, and it seemed like it simplified things for me.
Well, yeah, I appreciate your comments on that. You know, certainly, you know, credit cards can be very helpful as an acceptable payment option, especially when some of our attorneys are scaling up a practice and doing kind of a higher volume and expanding, and, you know, higher volume of leads and higher volume of referrals, and, you know, gives that, you know, that, you know, additional payment option to clients, where if they're taking a lot of payment plans or doing family law work where there's, you know, payments that are going out every month, it enables them to remove some of the administrative work around accepting payments. While at the same time, you know, I can see how this is totally working well for you, where you're doing, you know, a lot of fixed fees and working with folks as a solo practitioner, and you've got a specific set number of clients you're working with, and it's not worth the added expense. So it's good to hear kind of both sides of that coin. So attorneys can decide if it's something they want to, it's worthwhile to implement in their practice or not.
Yeah.
So what I'd love to explore a little bit further is you mentioned that, you know, you are offering a lot of fixed fees and basically unbundling in, you know, a lot of your services in your estate planning and litigation practice. Maybe what would be helpful is if you could just kind of lay out some of the different services that you offer fixed fees for. And obviously, you're breaking certain cases down into specific tasks. And I think it'd be really helpful for attorneys that are looking into, you know, being able to start unbundling services in the estate, you know, estate planning and estate litigation world to give them a lot of ideas on ways they can start to, you know, do things one task at a time and charge a fixed fee for each task. So maybe you can share a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the, you know, one of the tricks here in Texas is that if you're seeking to be appointed as the personal representative of an estate, I mean, you'd be acting as a fiduciary, and the court does not allow you to serve in that capacity without having an attorney of record on file. And so what I end up doing, you know, as far as unbundling estate administration work, probate work, you know, because the court requires that the person be represented, those in large part, I actually represent the client start to finish, and I, you know, it is a full engagement of my services. Now, the unbundling in that context really comes down to, let's look at all of the steps that we need to take, and do you have a deposit up front that is going to cover all of this? Great. Let me put that in my trust account, and we'll talk at least monthly to review what work has been done, what's left to do, and how much money you have left from your deposit. Other folks, you know, they're blue collar, they work hard, they do get paid well enough, either doing construction or driving trucks or something like that, you know, but they're not real big on saving necessarily. So they tend to have a lot of cash in hand, but they're very conscious of where they spend it and how they spend it. And so with those folks, you know, we break down, all right, in the first 4 weeks, you're going to be able to afford for me to take steps 1, 2, and 3. And then we're going to need to get another payment, that will cover, you know, these steps, but I end up doing a full engagement with them. It just impacts the timing of the work, and, you know, when the work gets done, what steps I actually take. And, you know, they're not keen on building up a real big bill. They'd rather pay for it as we go. And so, you know, it's unbundled in a sense, even though I'm, you know, essentially representing them throughout the entirety of the case. You know, I never really just prepare a document for them and set them loose to do with it what they will. You know, I am representing them throughout, but it, you know, it's some unbundling from that standpoint. Estate planning, you know, I tend to, I'm trying to think if there was even a single estate planning client where, you know, I drafted something for them that I didn't actually help them execute whenever we drafted it. And so, you know, it doesn't, the name of where my leads comes from doesn't necessarily reflect itself in the type of work that I do for folks, because the estate planning just gets done. You know, it's, you know, they come in, we do what they need done, and they walk out with their documents finished. With probate, they have to have me representing them, and the same with guardianship. You know, so it doesn't really turn into truly unbundled services, but learning how to break down the steps in a case and then quantify that into, you know, what an hourly billing would be or what a fixed fee would be for each of those tasks definitely enables me to work with folks that maybe, you know, they're always walking around with a certain amount of cash. They just never have anything saved up to put down a deposit. And so that's part of the flexibility of me being able to show them exactly what it is that I'm going to be doing and exactly what they need to be able to pay me. And so, yeah, it's the same skill set, I would say, but it's not a pure unbundled services like you may be able to offer in other areas of the law.
Well, yeah, and unbundling, the underlying intention behind it is to make your services more affordable by breaking things up into specific agreed upon tasks and going, you know, one step at a time. So that, you know, like you said, we have an access to justice problem and finding ways to work with people within their current budgets. And like you said, a lot of hardworking, you know, blue collar families out there that, you know, may, you know, be making a decent amount of cash in their job, but just don't have the savings. You need that form of flexibility. And the way in which you're working, I mean, unbundling doesn't mean that you have to, you know, remove yourself from the record or not become part of the record in order to provide these unbundled tasks. It's just like you said, like you're doing is where you're doing it. You know, you're breaking it up into specific tasks. So if you, you know, whereas most attorneys would say, okay, to get this whole thing done, it's going to be this amount of money to do all of it, right? Whereas what you're doing is you're saying, okay, well, let's break down what needs to be done here into its component parts and then bill one phase at a time. And this is also the way that most of our attorneys are unbundling in the immigration arena as well is, you know, with immigration, there's some, you know, some limitations on, you know, preparing documents for clients to go into federal court. That's been shifting as well a little bit, where attorneys are starting to have a little more freedom to be able to do the strict, you know, ghostwriting, essentially what that would be called. But, you know, for the majority, you know, you don't have to unbundle your being an attorney of record in order to be able to work with people in their budget. By just simply doing it as a pay as you go would be kind of a similar concept, where you're doing, you know, each set of tasks in phases, and if the time allows that, you know, and that's one of the things about immigration, and maybe that's the same, you know, it sounds like it's pretty similar to be true in estate planning, is that, you know, things don't necessarily have to happen, you know, within 2 weeks. The whole case doesn't have to get, you know, filed and resolved within 1 week, you know, whereas family law, sometimes you do have these types of really critical time factors where maybe you can't be as flexible with breaking things up over time. But similarly with immigration, you know, if there's time for these things to, you know, to take place, then, you know, starting to break things down into its component parts enables people to, you know, to afford, you know, continuing to have you as their attorney of record, simply because you're just not creating that huge upfront barrier that a lot of people are just not going to be in a position to climb when they're first starting in a case. So
yeah, I mean one area that you know, I think that the breaking your tasks down is a good practice, because I have noted in, you know, several of the cases where, you know, the way that I did that was to go back to some of my bills from dependent administrations where I had to take a lot of steps, and all of those had to be approved by the court, and eventually my bill had to be approved by the court, and I just went back to those bills and broke those down into essentially a checklist of all the, you know, all the tasks that might need to be done, and then, you know, looked at how long it took me to handle those tasks. You know, in each of those, I think it was three cases that I used to do that. And so whenever I did that, you know, you notice, well, I'm really efficient at doing, you know, getting these notices out and getting these letters out to creditors and things of that sort. You know, I was really, really quite quick at doing those. But then I was spending, you know, whenever it came time for accountings, I realized I was spending more time than the court was willing to pay me for. And so just the going through the process of breaking that down and noticing here's where the court's saying, you know, you shouldn't need more than 4 or 5 hours to get this task done. And, you know, the accounting part, I'm not really a numbers guy, and so it was taking me a good bit longer than that. And what I found was that was a step where I could actually make better use of my time by getting the client to just get a bookkeeper to to keep track of all the accounting, so that it gets delivered to me in a format. Now I'm spending way less time on it than the court would, you know, down to about 2 hours to get everything assembled, you know, which is actually even less time than the court would probably allow me to bill. You know, they were allowing 4 and 5 hours, and I'm actually getting it done faster than that. And so, you know, is that good business? I don't know, but you know, I think just providing as efficient and competent a service to the client is really, that's the focus, and you know, it'll pay dividends in the end. And so, yeah, just breaking things down, I think offers a lot of benefits, apart from, you know, even the unbundling of services.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder I think it might be helpful for, if you have any examples of a specific kind of case in which you would break up specific tasks and maybe up into its component parts and then how you would bill accordingly. Like maybe you can give an example of one specific kind of case and then some of the component parts that are part of it and then how you might bill that client to be able to enable them to, you know, obviously have a lot more likelihood that they're able to afford that one step at a time.
Sure. So, whenever I'm probating a will and just doing a simple administration of the estate, there's a couple of steps in there. You know, there's the preparing the application, you know, going over the will with the client, making sure you got the right party in interest there to actually file the application. And so I spend, you know, a couple hours there with them, and usually, you know, during that first meeting, I explained to him, look, the time we're spending together is going to be reflected on your bill because we're doing some substantive work here. You know, it's not just like a free consultation. We're actually, if we're going to move forward with this, let's get our engagement agreement in place early on in our meeting and then actually put together an application and get our ducks in a row for how we're going to handle your case. And so then, you know, they go ahead and pay me a deposit that covers the time that we've spent getting that work done, the filing fees that are going to be needed by the county clerk. And then there's some work that I have to do to do the prove up documents and then set our hearing, get the original will delivered to the court. And so then we start with, here, pay me enough to do the work today to get your application prepared and filed. And then the day of the hearing, here's the steps that I will have taken between now and the hearing. And here's the time that we'll spend there. And so here's the dollar amount that you need to bring me. You need to give me this check at the courthouse, or if we're coming back to my office after, you can bring it then, but I need to get paid that day. And usually between the citation period that has to run and then the court's docket, you know, usually you're a month out or so, sometimes more than that between the filing and the actual hearing. And so that gives people, you know, a little bit of breathing room to get a little more money in hand to be able to pay the next installment. And then, you know, we set a time. If they're ready to do it, we can sit down, get all of our notices prepared and sent out and get their inventory of the estate put together. Sometimes they need some time to gather, you know, the backup documentation, bank statements, car titles, deeds to the house, et cetera, so that I can prepare that inventory of the estate. And so that's another one of those real natural, you know, and they have to, it's, you know, it's sworn, so they need to come into my office and sign it anyway. So there's the initial meeting, then there's the meeting at the courthouse, and then we have another meeting after that, a little bit further down the road. The inventories don't need to be returned for 90 days. You can even ask for extensions. So, so that gives them a little more time to get a little more money in hand. So, you know, I'll end up accepting 3 or 4 payments over, say a 6-month period. And that works for the client and it reflects the work that I'm actually doing, you know, at the time that they're paying me for it. So, it's kind of a pay as you go, and it seems to work out real naturally just because of, you know, the deadlines involved and the timeline in most cases.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's surprising when you lay it out. It isn't really all that complicated. to work with people in this manner. It just takes a little bit of flexibility, like just some basic, you know, hey, if you don't have that up front, okay, well, let's just break things up. Let's look at all the things that are involved. I mean, it doesn't even sound like it takes that long. You know, if you've done a similar type of case a couple times, you can pretty much break down what are all the different phases. How long are they going to take? What are the different, you know, and then you can come up with, you know, specific, you know, barriers of time in which you need to collect each payment as you go. I mean, this isn't even like got complicated. It's almost baffling that more attorneys aren't doing this type of unbundled, you know, pay as you go type of approach to working with folks. I don't know if it's, you know, budget concerns or, you know, I don't know. It just doesn't seem to make much sense. They don't believe that the client will pay it, so they feel like they have to get the money up front. I mean, that must be the major reason. Is like, well, if you don't pay me up front, then I basically don't have faith in you to make the payments. I mean, that must be one of the primary considerations. You know, do you ever have these conversations with other attorneys and hear their feedback on why they wouldn't offer these types of options?
Yeah, and you know, one of those conversations was with one of the attorneys that I used to work for. And that was one of the, well, you know, attorneys in general are risk averse. You know, we all see sort of the worst case scenario, and that's the field that we work in. You know, we're dealing with other folks' worst case scenarios. And so one of the problems, especially in litigation, of, okay, so you get your judgment, but then you actually have to go and collect it. And so we're just programmed to, get your money up front. Don't put your faith in people actually doing what they say they're going to do. I think that's just part of what you experience working as an attorney, is that, you know, people's word is not their bond. And so you're just predisposed to not really trust your clients, I guess is a way to put it. So, you know, part of that is, go out on a limb a little bit for some of these folks. But you know, there's also a satisfaction I get out of doing that whenever I see folks that, you know, dealing with estates, I'm dealing with a lot of widows and orphans at times. And so, and kind of have a heart for that. And so whenever they've gone to other attorneys who demand these larger fees, essentially those attorneys just don't trust that these people will pay them at the end of the day. From a cash flow standpoint, it's kind of odd because, you know, ethically we put this in a trust account and we're not supposed to draw from it until the work's done anyway. So if you're demanding $5,000 and $10,000 retainers that you're not going to finish drawing from until 6 or 12 months down the road, and I'm demanding a much smaller amount up front, and I still get paid 6 to 12 months down the road, you know, it just seems like there's a little bit more risk in the way that I handle it. I mean, I'll acknowledge that. But I've yet to really have it come back to bite me. You know, there's been one or two instances where the client just won't follow through and pay. Given the volume of clients that I've been able to take on that are so appreciative of the fact that I'll even take their case. Yep. And then they're eager to pay me whenever they have the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that we've talked about that before when attorneys have shared the payment plans they offer and the willingness to work with folks, is, you know, how easy it is for attorneys to focus on the clients that don't pay. You know, like you said, you've got one or two, but they fail to take into account the upside, which is all the clients that they've, you know, the high volume of clients that they've been able to work with that, like you said, are very appreciative of your willingness to work with them in that way. And is there any way that you could like ballpark off the top of your head what the amount of people, I mean, this would be really hard to do, but the amount of people that you've been able to acquire as clients because of the way you work with them versus the ones that, you know, ended up, you know, not paying you, you know, to kind of set a contrast? Is it like one out of every, you know, 30 clients that you work with on this basis doesn't go through? And so you added on 30 more clients that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford you, but, you know, maybe had one that didn't pay. I mean, is there any kind of ratio we could draw here just to set the contrast?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's somewhere in the neighborhood of like 50 to 1.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, if I take on 100 clients a year and two of them, you know, stiff me, yeah, I mean, it's just not that many. And, you know, it's hard to, you know, just off the top of my head to weed out how many clients I have that are able to pay fees up front versus clients that I get because of my flexibility to wait on getting paid later. But I would say better than half of the cases that I take on are folks that need some type of alternative arrangement whenever it comes to fees. You know, so it's a, you know, it's pretty good proportion of folks that so 30-1 is probably pretty close to accurate as far as the number of clients that I've been able to take on because I didn't demand the larger fee versus the, you know, one or two folks that end up not paying whenever the time comes.
Okay. And I just can't help myself to go one step further here. If we just look at the financials of that, is there any way you could do like an estimation? Obviously, you've got a lot of different kinds of cases going on. You've got estates planning, you've got the planning side, you have the litigation, but do you have some concept of maybe the average client value, you know, it, over the course of the 6 to 12 months of working with them, you know, working with them in the spaces, they're still ended up paying the same amount. They're just doing it over time. Do you have an idea of what each client is worth? You know, on average, if you were to kind of, you know, blend it with like a really broad kind of brush, obviously you got, you know, some people that just want a will, and then you got the far side of the contested litigation cases. Can you estimate what that is?
Yeah, so I'd say it's somewhere, and maybe this is a wild range, but you know, somewhere in the $3,000 to $6,000 range. Because some of those, and that's kind of hard to quantify, because some of the longer term contested cases, you know, those go into the $15,000-$20,000 worth of fees, sometimes higher than that. And so, those are really outliers. So if you take those out of the mix, yeah, you're probably, you know, average client value is at least $3,000 and probably closer to $5,000. So once you factor in the really long-term cases, yeah, I mean, you know, the average client value for me is pretty high.
Okay, so let's just look at those numbers real quick. So if it's 30-1 conservatively, it was probably, you know, around that. That means out of 30 cases, he has one client that, you know, you do maybe, and they don't even not pay you for the whole thing. They might only just not pay you for part of it, right? So, let's just suppose they don't pay you for the whole thing. So you're out $3,000 for the one client, and then you've got 30 clients that you otherwise would have had to turn away or couldn't afford you because if you had been rigid about needing their upfront retainer, but instead these people were able, you were able to work with them, and they ended up paying you the $3,000 to $5,000 or so in services over the course of time that you were able to now acquire because of that. So we've got, you know, 30 times 3,000. I think that's about $90,000, almost $100,000 versus $6,000 lost. And so that's a, you know, you're basically profiting by being willing to work with people in this way and unbundled services and offer the pay as you go. You're, you know, another 90 or so, maybe $87,000 more profitable a year. Obviously, we're doing broad strokes, but even if you were conservative, it's an extra $50,000 or so. You know, and again, this, I think that's like the lawyers aren't doing the math. You know, we can do this out in 10 minutes, but it just seems like, and not only that, I mean, it's just from a financial perspective is the only way we're looking at it, but just, I mean, think about all the folks that, like you said, are just appreciative of the fact that you're willing to work with them, help them out. Obviously, you're talking about orphans, you're talking about widows, people are going through a really difficult time in their lives. The last thing they want to worry about is how the heck they're going to come up with the money to pay an attorney to handle these types of issues. And so just the fact that you're able to work with people in that way, I mean, you must get a lot of out of that, just even with all that extra, you know, financial benefit aside.
Yeah. And, you know, you're also, most people are fairly tapped out after having paid for the funeral, you know, so, you know, they come to you after having just paid, you know, $8,000, $10,000, $15,000 on services and all of that. So by the time they come to you, yeah, they're not they're not just flush with cash necessarily. And so it's rewarding in the sense that, it comes down more to that, that interest in problem solving, you know. And so some of the issues that people come to you with are legal, you know, and specifically require you to have a law license to be able to address those issues. There's other issues that they come to you with that are, you know, they're part of the mix that are not necessarily legal issues. They're either financial issues, personality problems, you know, conflict between siblings, things of that sort. And so it all goes into that. Let's figure out what the final result looks like, and let's kind of work backwards from there to figure out everything that needs to happen. But then, you know, what are the steps that we need to take now to get this process started? And so you ultimately come down to a series of problems, you know, legal and non-legal, that I get the pleasure of trying to solve for people. And so it's a, you know, I think that's a lot of the satisfaction and reward out of it is, you know, it's always a bit of a puzzle, how you're going to make things work for people that don't, you know, haven't saved for a rainy day and don't have the means to just shell out, you know, thousands of dollars at a clip, and yet still be able to provide them good representation. And so that's the, you know, it's fairly rewarding, you know, to tell people that there's actually light at the end of the tunnel. There's actually a solution to the bind that they find themselves in.
Well, and this is really the underpinning of the solution to our access to justice problem is attorneys' perception. I think this is one of the major, you know, kind of false assumptions per se, is that attorneys assume that if they unbundle or offer these pay-as-you-go options, that it's not profitable. It's just not beneficial to the firm to offer these types of options. And so I really appreciate you, you know, sharing, you know, how it is that you're working with folks in this way, how profitable and to your practice it has been, because, you know, I think once we can get this message out there and have attorneys start to realize, you know, start to calculate just for a minute the economics, you know, of unbundling. I mean, if unbundling and the access to justice problem was something we had to, you know, lawyers had to volunteer their way out of or go broke in the process doing, yeah, we would probably have a problem that's unsustainable, that's not fixable in this country. But the reality is that unbundling done properly can actually be very, very profitable for the attorney. So not only can they, you know, impact and serve a lot of other people that otherwise would be going unrepresented, unserved, but they can also make a lot of money and even a lot more money doing that. And I don't think there's been any more, you know, more clear, you know, layout of how, you know, that is the case with your examples here. So just really appreciate you being that example, so that attorneys can start to really question, you know, the assumptions that maybe they've been trained, you know, for years and years and years, and it's understandable. That's the culture of attorney, you know, of the law practice, that, you know, you have to, you know, there's just natural distrust for the client, and, you know, that you have to get the money up front. But, you know, there's a whole other way of looking at it, which is, like you're describing it, a very client-centered approach, where you're looking at it from the standpoint of how can I serve this client? You know, how can I make sure that they're getting, you know, next forward to the process and come up with, you know, problem-solving solutions and flexible solutions that can work around their budget? And as a result, it seems to be working really well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so we'll go ahead and wrap up there. And Ross, again, thank you so much for taking the time to share this stuff. It's really, really, really helpful. And we'll be certain to share this episode to any estate lawyers that are coming on board and, you know, maybe didn't have a lot of experience, you know, offering these types of pay-as-you-go, unbundled types of services in the estate world. So I thank you for your insights and for sharing you know, the process and the numbers with that. And to everyone else that's listening, we certainly appreciate you, you know, tuning into the podcast, taking notes and learning how to implement these types of unbundled options and more affordable approaches in your practice. It absolutely does make a difference in our ability to close the access to justice gap, and it's very doable. So spread the word, share the podcast with other attorneys that, you know, may not, you know, share the same ideology. I mean, I've had conversations with attorneys that didn't originally believe that unbundled was something they could offer in their practice, that, you know, once they kind of started to see the numbers and see the impact they could have in people's lives and also the profitability behind it, began offering these types of services, and the amount of people that are able to get served by attorneys that do is tremendous if we can duplicate that across the entire country. So thank you so much for participating in the podcast and being a part of that movement. And we will certainly see you all on the next episode. For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.